So I'd like to start by inviting you, if you dare, at an academic conference, to not take notes. Because, you know, you can always download the paper. And I'd also like to invite you, if you feel comfortable to posture yourselves, whatever way is helpful for you to listen most deeply. So if that means closing your eyes, if it means sitting on the floor, lying down, whatever it is, feel free to adopt a posture that's going to help you to listen as we talk about listening. Let me start by sharing with you one of my favourite all-time quotes from David Augsburger, who says that being heard is so close to being loved that for the average person they are almost indistinguishable. Being heard is so close to being loved that for the average person they are almost indistinguishable. One of our most fundamental callings in life, in faith, in being a human being is to listen well. Because to listen well is to love well. So what it means to listen in such a way and what factors make it particularly difficult or challenging to listen in such a way, particularly when it comes to conversations of faith and spirituality, is what prompted the research for my master's thesis. And so if you'd like to read more about the particular context of that, the paper is where to go. Context being Christian mentoring and spiritual direction, both fields that I work in. In the time we've got today, though, I want to broaden the field and briefly explore some thoughts around how one's personal faith convictions, our operative theologies, whether they be personal or communal, have the power to disrupt our listening to another person. Who I am, how I am, what I think actually has the power to disrupt my listening to another person. Particularly when I'm confronted by difference. So that's the dynamic I explored in my research, and I think it has genuine implications for transformation in another person, whatever that transformation looks like. So here are the key learnings for me that came out of the research about the transformative power of deep, embodied, attentive listening. Contemplative listening is an expression of faith. It's an expression of hope and an expression of love. To listen in this way can be a declaration of my faith without words. If the act of contemplation can be described as a long, loving look at the real, then contemplative listening is a posture of deep, embodied attentiveness to the other, held within an awareness of the presence of God. To listen this way is to realise radical trust in God, radical trust in the other, releasing any desire I might have for power, for control, or for direction in a spiritual conversation. Because I think if we're honest with ourselves, at least if I'm honest with myself, I often have the desire and sometimes exercise the power for control in a conversation. Contemplative listening is faith enacted. Henry Nouwen said that contemplation is to think, speak, and live in the presence of God. So when I listen to another person, I listen in this presence. It invites me to lean back, to relax, to release, to rest in the power of the Spirit, to bring about direction and restoration and wholeness in another person. Contemplative listening invites me to release my desire to know, to fix, to teach, to speak, to tell, to exhort, to instruct. And that's not to say that these things are never appropriate to act on. Of course they are. However, a contemplative listening posture means an increasing ability for me as the listener to recognise the crucial moments in the transformative journey of another person. And to surrender my desires to know, to fix, to teach, to tell, etc. And instead hold a hospitable space which concedes my own power for the good of the other person. And this opens up the possibility for both the speaker and myself as the listener to be witnesses to the mystery of transformation. This kind of listening can be a real challenge, I think, for anyone, and particularly so, my research would indicate, for those whose operative theology is on high alert to theological difference. That was the case for the Christian mentors in my study, who largely represent the Reformed evangelical and evangelical traditions, and also largely represent the traditions represented in Christian mentoring, particularly in Sydney, where I'm from. Sydney is a strange beast when it comes to denomination. So the tendency to react, to correct difference, any kind of difference in theology, is almost a reflex action. So what does this look like in real life? I think it would be safe to say that all of us in this room have at times experienced what it is like to be in a conversation with someone when you know they're not really listening, or that they've stopped listening, or that they're listening in order to have their say and tell you what they really think. And I've likened this to a little bit like, the reflex hammer. I don't know if doctors even do that anymore, but a reflex hammer that tests the reflex in the knee and kicks it forward, taps the knee, patella, and your leg kicks forward involuntarily. And to be honest, I think it's a little bit like that, this tendency to correct. Unfortunately, I think it's also a bit of a fitting metaphor for what it can feel like on the other end of someone who reflexively corrects or interrupts in order to put me on the right theological path. No matter how well-intentioned, we all know what it's like to receive a metaphorical kick. Just be careful where you stand. And that kind of kick, that kind of reaction, can actually be a blockage to authentic growth and transformation in the person to whom I am listening. Contemplative listening provides space to be heard at a soul level, and to trust a person to make meaning of their own experience. As contemplative listeners, then, we actually walk the road of discovery with others rather than tell them the direction in which we think they ought to go. It doesn't negate the power or the appropriateness of the spoken word, of gospel truth, as my evangelical mentors might name it, but it actually deepens our capacity to recognise when the spoken word may be immature or unwanted or perhaps even unnecessary. Adam had a beautiful poem yesterday. He talked about the way that God listens without saying a word. Contemplative listening within spiritual accompaniment is always a dynamic and fluid relationship. It includes an awareness of and attentiveness to the activity of God within myself, within the other, between us. It requires reflexivity as a listening partner and an orientation towards God, who is in all and through all and over all, whether or not God is explicitly named in the conversation. Ultimately, it's a disposition, it's a way of being. It's about living an embodied, holistic life with no separation of the sacred and the secular. It's a way of being that welcomes or even embraces the challenges that come with recognising difference. So to avoid any theological or doctrinal or denominational echo chambers where nothing new ever happens, only the reverberation of our own voices, a contemplative listening posture requires a necessary shift for me as the listener to what might be a theologically unfamiliar place, a willingness to be disturbed, even to suspend my own certainty for the sake of the other. Silence is a necessary partner in this kind of listening. Silence is part of contemplative listening. It is co-inherent, distinct from listening, but also inseparable. The invitation to us as we listen to another is to rest in this silence, to allow ourselves to be held by the source of all spiritual guidance, prayerfully entrusting the process of growth to the one who makes all spiritual growth possible. So to ground our experience, if you're able to keep all of that in mind, or even one of those things in mind, the characteristics of contemplative listening, I'd like to facilitate a little bit of an imaginary exercise. So to do that, again, encourage you to close your eyes, get comfortable. And I want you to bring to mind, if you can, someone who is dear to you, someone with whom you might have regular conversations of faith and spirituality. Someone you want to listen to on their journey. Now I want you to imagine that there's a vehicle. This vehicle is the space in which your conversation is going to take place. There are only two seats in this vehicle, side by side. As you look at this vehicle, you notice that it does not have a steering wheel. There's no accelerator and no brake. Just a little button on the dashboard that has a question mark on it. As you imagine that, just notice what you're feeling in this moment. Notice your emotions. Notice how your body is responding to getting into a vehicle with no way to drive. This vehicle is powered by a source which is both outside of and inside of you and your companion. Let's call that source Holy Mystery. All you and your companion need to do is get in. Either one of you can stop and leave the vehicle at any time. To start the vehicle, both you and your companion are required to press the button with a question mark on it. Again, invite you just to notice your thoughts, your emotions, how your body responds. Your conversation with your companion begins, and the vehicle starts to slowly move steadily forward. Notice now within you any sense of direction about where the vehicle might be going. Notice what you feel. As your conversation continues with your companion, and you're offering your presence and your awareness and your attentiveness, your hospitality in your listening, the vehicle continues to move. I want you to imagine that your companion shares something with you that you react to. This might be something that's quite contrary to your own personal faith convictions, your own beliefs. And you notice that it stirred something within you. What are your thoughts? What are your feelings? What do you notice in your body? You've reached a crossroads in your journey with your conversation companion. And there are any number of roads you might take from here in your desire to listen. I wonder what they might be for you. See if any of these fit. Safety? Curiosity? Control? Correction? Surrender, discomfort, risk, trust. Notice that question mark button. I wonder if you're able to trust that this vehicle, powered by holy mystery, actually knows where it's going. Notice that question mark button again. In your imagination, what happens next? And when you feel ready, just invite you to come back into this space. And I won't ask for your responses, but I'll ask you to consider your responses. What happens next? What's the invitation in every conversation for you? Thank you for your attention.
Way of engaging us. Okay.
Okay. Thank you for the time. The theme of the conference is really the thing that drew me from Cape Town to Adelaide, because it was looking and it was curious about an alternative way, a Christian spirituality that responds to our time, a spirituality that's conversational, that is hopeful, transformative, relevant to everyday life. So I thought about the theme of a dance, and the dance is a number of touch points, but the main important part of that motif for me, that a dance usually requires two. I know some people are happy to put themselves out there on their own, but usually a dance requires two or more people, and hospitality is at the center of that theme. So I want to tell you three stories, just very quickly. They're not really stories. One is an experience. The other one is a story from Scripture. And the third one is a visio divina, an icon. So the first story is something that I experienced in 2019. In October, I attended a conference in the U.S. And as part of that conference, on the first evening, there was an opportunity to attend a dinner church. I had never attended such a thing before, and I was glad to have not everybody in the conference could go. There was a limited space, but we arrived on the evening, and tables were set out, round tables, and people were sitting around those tables, and it was free seating, and we all were encouraged to take a seat somewhere. So another companion from the conference and I sat at a table. We were the only two from the conference there, and the others around the table were people who were there on a regular basis. And the first thing that struck me was the diverse dynamic. There was a professional person there. I can't remember. It might have been a doctor or a lawyer or something. And then there were a couple of other people there, and it turned out in conversation that at least two of them were marginalized in vulnerable situations on grants and so on. But we enjoyed a meal together, a shared meal, and then listened to a speaker. And in the process, I thought, am I experiencing something about church that I've never experienced before? Something about Christian community? Because my previous experience had always been in the traditional and the inherited model. Was it possible that hospitality, which seemed to be at the center of this experience, was providing these people in the room, including myself, a step towards interpersonal transformation? The second story comes from the book of Genesis, the Hebrew scriptures, and it tells a very simple story about Abram and Sarah entertaining strangers under the great trees of Mamre. It's a classic biblical story. It's a beautiful story in its simplicity. It expresses an ancient Oriental a sense of comfort with strangers. And I'm sure some of you may know the story. I'm not going to tell it in full. By the way, I've got a copy here if you want to read some of the detail. But basically, Abraham notices three strangers. They're unknown to him. He has no connection with them. But his instinct is to invite them to a simple meal. Well, of course, he under-promises and over-delivers, because it's actually a lavish meal. And these are strangers, but for those who read the story, not the characters in the story, we're told that the Lord, the big L-O, the capital L-O-R-D, appeared to Abram as the strangers under the trees of Mamre. There is a meal and an exchange. They move on, but before moving on, they leave a gift. And the gift is the announcement of the birth of Isaac. Now, in and of itself, that may be a simple story, but could it be possible that those three persons entertained by Abraham were in fact the Lord God Almighty accepting hospitality from a human being? Could it be possible that the Godhead, as Camparis, and I think I've got the quote here, Camparis, the Orthodox theologian, says, "The Godhead is received as a guest in his own home, and clad in incorruptible form, partakes of the food that will be transformed through his own extension of hospitality into incorruptible nourishment, his own flesh and blood distributed symbolically to the whole hospitable domain of his creation. Well, that's the second story. So the third story is perhaps a more well-known, at least visual one, and in itself it's a visio divina. You could sit in front of this icon, which is called the Trinity, written, because icons are written and not painted, by Andrei Rublev in the 15th century. And in this icon, which is very famous, and which in fact was declared by the Orthodox Church as one of the close to perfect representations of what an icon should be. So in this particular icon, it seems that what Rublev is doing is to try to represent this ancient story of what happened under the trees of Mamre. And you can read for yourself. I'm not going to go into the details of who the characters are, because that, I think, is part of the beauty, is to sit and try to uncover who's who, you know, which is which. If this is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, which is which? But Rublev takes us into a mystical moment as we sit in front of this icon, because Rublev expresses this simple act of human hospitality as a turning around of the tables. Rublev wants to express to us something of the perichoretic dance, the dance of the inner Trinitarian life. And what Rublev also wants to do is he wants to encourage us to see that the whole story is being transformed by the presence of God. The tree of Mamre becomes the tree of life. The house of Abraham becomes the dwelling place of God with us. And the mountain in the icon, painted in the icon, becomes the spiritual heights of prayer and contemplation. The story is being transformed. And what's more is that you and I are called to participate in the story because of the vacant space at the table. We're invited in. The party won't be the same without us. But at the same time, we must accept this is the little cavity that contained in ancient times the relics, the bones of the saints. So we must accept that the participation may involve suffering in terms of our witness. Rublev has helped us to see that an act of hospitality by human beings to God can become an act of hospitality of God to us. And it runs to such a deep level that we are invited into the inter-Trinitarian life and swept up in that great dance that lies at the center of all things. Is it possible that an act of hospitality or a sustained commitment to the human spiritual practice of hospitality might result in a reciprocal mystical act of hospitality on the part of God? Can God use hospitality to transform us? In the process of us reaching out to the other, the stranger, is it possible that we might be changed in ways we can't even imagine? In his book, Reaching Out, the Catholic contemporary mystic Henry Nouwen invites us to understand the spiritual life in terms of pendulum swings or swinging between poles. He breaks away from the traditional model of stages of the spiritual journey, and he expresses his spiritual journey in these three acts: from loneliness to solitude, a personal journey. But then he goes on in the second swing to talk about a movement from hostility to hospitality. And at first it jars a little to talk about hostility. You think, well, I'm not really a hostile person. That's not who I am. But then you sit on the subway or on the tram and you realize I'm not talking to anyone. And it's not just my introversion. You know, I'm not sure who they are and what do they want. You know, and what might they want to take from me? So the hostility is an inbred thing. It's something which we carry with us. But if we are able to make that swing from hostility to hospitality, that in itself offers us an opportunity for growth, interpersonal transformation. Henry Nouwen talks about the fact that the world seemed full of strangers until he noticed that they were in fact friends. So there's a word he uses in the Dutch, gastvrijheid, and that's an interesting corollary. It's an interesting sort of footnote to what hospitality is all about. If the guest is not free, is it really hospitality? And in the process of the hospitality, do we try to form people in our own likeness? Do we want them to be like us, to accept our customs? Is our warmth towards them, does our warmth towards them grow if they become more like us, or if we find things in common? Hospitality, therefore, means primarily the creation of a free space where the stranger can enter and become a friend instead of an enemy. And then he goes on, and I printed this in the article for you to read. He says, I came from a Dutch Catholic family where it was clear who we were, so who we were and who they were. They were all non-Catholics. They were non-believers. They got divorced or were gay. While we were okay because we believed the right teachings and lived a moral life. My family, my community, my seminary, my church felt very safe and secure because the patterns and expectations were so clearly defined. Gradually, while I was teaching at Yale and Harvard, my fences and defenses began falling away. When I arrived at L'Arche, bang, 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 my whole worldview crumbled. One of the things that I point out in the article is that the practice of hospitality is attractive to me because it is set among ordinary people in everyday life. It's not something that's necessary. Well, it's not something that's practiced primarily in a, you know, sort of cloister in a secluded environment. It's practiced in everyday life. And Michel de Chateau has helped us in his writing to see how spiritual practices, practices which we regarded as belonging to a sort of specific secluded environment, are in fact practiced in everyday life, can in fact be practiced in everyday life. And then at the end of this paper, I look at how that can be done using the writings primarily of two spiritual writers. Firstly, the American Anglican Barbara Brown Taylor, who writes about spiritual practices in her beautiful book, An Altar in the World. And then secondly, in the literature of Christine Pohl, who writes specifically on the practice of hospitality. Well, let me leave this with you, because I think it is important to admit that because of obvious reasons attached to Western culture, hospitality is difficult to practice. In fact, when I was first looking at that, thinking about the Mamre story, I thought to myself, how do I feel putting myself in the shoes of Abraham? And these are, I'm ashamed to tell you, but these are some of the words I came up with. Awkward. This is dangerous. Excessive. Showy. Unnecessary. There are challenges and limitations to hospitality. All of us have limited time and limited resource. And I think that's as true of communities as it is for individuals. And finally, there is a reluctance that we feel within us. The value of privacy in Western culture is so pervasive. But these challenges can be faced when we think of the possibilities of transformation that are offered to us. So I thought of one question I'd like to ask you, and I'm quite happy for you to decide whether you do this on your own, because it may be personal, it may be emotional, or to talk with someone around the table about this. And the question is this: can you think of an experience of hospitality that turned out to be transformative for you? describe how it changed you. Can you think of an experience of hospitality that turned out to be transformative for you, and describe how it changed you? There should be, yes. Certainly the icon.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. The visuals are really helpful.
Mm. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your help with that. It's helpful.
Hello everyone, I'm Cullen. I think that to reflect on this, this is, you know, I know the abstract is very abstract and very... but the thing is that I've reflected on the last couple of days is that it's actually also a story of my own approach to the scholarship and in response to today. So I'm going to talk a little bit about myself, so that you get a sense of the issue that I'm talking about, which really is the clash between my own ongoing experience of living in the world, but also how do I engage with the scholarship and training that I've had through theology and philosophy and spirituality in a way that actually can contribute something, which I feel is not an easy thing to do. So, but just to, by way of kind of introduce it, because... you know, no one, you probably, none of you really know me, but I've been in the privilege of working with a centre of group of people. We had a bequest of, you know, about $10 million, which was given to us to study contemplative practices. So I've been very privileged to work with some of the top researchers in the world in contemplative research. And so I'm not saying that as a brag, but to give you the context a little bit. So I work with Julieta Galante and Nicholas Van Dam. Both are, you know, Julieta's in health science and health research, and Nicholas Van Dam is a very well-respected contributor to mindfulness research, also anthropologists and educational people. And that's me in the middle, actually not wearing the same pants. So I'll ask also, Phil, can you just keep me to time just in case? But the reason that I want to... So my story, unfortunately, is this kind of really weird mix. So what I want to talk about a little bit is how that process is actually feeding into the questions that I've had to say. Look, so I started off in northwest Tasmania. I moved around Australia. My first interactions as a kind of a contemporary seeker was to go to a Buddhist monastery for 2 years, based in Queensland. I then studied Catholic theology at a Catholic university, and after that I was actually sexually assaulted by a priest. And so it's not been an easy journey, really, because it's like in the middle of my final years, I was an adult, but as in the middle of my final years, I had, you know, that kind of experience of someone who I considered I thought was a spiritual director in some way, and, you know, violated that trust. So I then went on to, for some reason, I decided to do a doctorate after that. I didn't really come to terms with any of it all. But I then, you know, went on to... I lived in Vietnam and China, and I've taught philosophy and spirituality at Catholic Theological College, where John DePoosh, who's just walked in, is there. I've also worked extensively with mindfulness and meditation communities. But I also mentioned my heavy involvement with environmental activism and Extinction Rebellion. And just to mention, too, as a reflection this morning, so who was on the right-hand side or on the left-hand side of the drum line? Right? Yeah. So on the one that where it didn't go forward. All right. That was my fault. No, I'm serious. I'll tell you what. So what happens here, and this is why I mentioned, I'm actually quite, in a sense, quite brave. I've had to confront bishops and people related to myself, but I've also been beaten up by cops and during you know, non-violent direct action, and was heavily involved in these kinds of things. But when it came to trying to pass on the rhythm, as soon as I had met any kind of resistance from the person I was with, I just kind of paralysed. I couldn't do it. So I didn't pass on. I didn't go to the next person. I couldn't do it. And so the reason why I bring this up is because I feel like in the last 10 or so years, a lot of us within spirituality have been confronted by huge ranges of changes, not even, you know, mentioning the ecological crises, but the emergence of mindfulness research has really shaken a lot of us because of how it seems to apply quite technical and scientific approaches to things that we prefer to remain as very, you know, kind of personal and spiritual. And I think to some extent, there's a range of internal and external challenges that Christians and others are facing that is quite unprecedented. And so a lot of the concern that I had is, well, how do these different things speak to each other? So in terms of my attempt to get beyond my paralysis is to think, well, how can we talk with one another, whether or not that's possible? So I won't take you to... How am I going for time, Phil?
You're 5 minutes so far.
5 minutes so far. I don't want to take you too much into the detail, but from the preliminary research we've done at the centre, and it's probably very intuitive for most of the practitioners here, we're doing research into meditation practices. So practices based in religious traditions tend to have, you know, of course they have different motivations for undertaking the practice than mindfulness practitioners. But indications from various surveys, etc., saying that people from religious traditions often practice for longer periods, or, you know, over an extended period of time in their lives. But they also have unusual experiences. We did some work on unusual experiences, people who have unusual experiences during meditation practice and what happens there. So religious people or people based in religious traditions have comparable levels of unusual experiences. However, the one interesting thing is that along with the longevity of practice is that people from religious traditions tend to cope better with unusual experiences. I'm not saying traumatic or non-traumatic. I'm saying that they tend to experience these things in a kind of more positive sense. So one of the things that motivates my scholarship and you know, Gary's, you know, kind of coming to slightly, you know, bring in another important theme related to the decolonizing of the scholarship is, well, what aspects of religious traditions do support people to progress, definitely in inverted commas, but help to people to cope with difficult experiences and unusual experiences. And so my idea here was to take you through a little bit of my engagement with centering prayer as a note. But as I said, when a researcher, a mindfulness researcher, wants to talk to a person from a religious tradition, a term that they'll often talk about that is a necessary thing for having this dialogue is operationalizing. Well, what that will refer to is that when a person wants to talk about their, you know, the spirituality of their practice or use theological language, for a mindfulness, a psychologist, they need to hear the operations, they need to hear the processes, not because they're dismissive of the experience, but they need to be able to track it. And so one thing that happens is to just say, well, okay, if I wanted to investigate what's happening within, say, centering prayer, I need to examine the range of processes, the mechanisms, the intentional, the cognitive, the psychological, the element of the emotional elements that go into the practice that make the person that help the person practice. This is not even talking about the community and the ritual. This is actually just looking at the pure practice. So it's very artificial, but that's where we start. but also what happens in when the theological and psychological elements mix and connect, what happens within that process, and how does each one affect one another, but also to how does this, these different things frame the different experience that people have. So I won't go too much into that, but just to mention that that there are some ways that we investigate contemplative practices that are very abstract and very dry, and that they take a lot of the life out of it. But the reason is we are trying to look at, well, what's happening when the person practices? How do we ensure that their experience can happen for a longer term and it be more positive, so to speak? Positive I don't mean as being always lovely, but is that actually something that's fulfilling and leads to flourishing rather than detriment? So my language that I think is helpful is what I'm trying to explore is more of the layering. So look, I was going to take you through some of the terms that get used, but I don't think we'll have time for that. But just to say that mindfulness researchers use operational definitions or definitions of meditation practice that kind of take processes and then see how they work. That actually this can also be applied to a practice such as centering prayer. But of course, one thing to say is that the more complex a practice is, the harder it is for a researcher to track it. So for instance, even Vipassana and some aspects of Zen that use koans, for instance, are harder for a researcher to track than a very basic form of mindfulness. And that's one of the reasons why mindfulness has been so successful, is that it's simplified. So when it comes to things like transcendental, transcendental in a very bare sense, hidden, and experience of non-dual states, although they're very common, it's still something that the researchers struggle with to catch up with. And there's also some variations of this. So look, now, just very briefly, centering prayer, of course, has elements that we could talk about as being operations. We could talk about having some type of attentional focus through the application of a sacred word. But what we would say is that, from a research perspective, is that it has more of an emphasis on almost a non-dual awareness and open monitoring or metacognition. That would be the way that we'd express it. So it has a different focus than, say, a mindfulness practice, different emphasis. Just to suggest this is possible. So in a sense that, some of the religious practices have many of the features that are common to mindfulness. But as well as these many, many features that are outside of the general scope of mindfulness practice. Engagement with thoughts in more complex ways, examination of the causes of my emotions, and experiences that relate to ideas of true or false self, for instance. They're all outside, just generally outside of it. Also, the main intention of the practice to some extent is difficult to capture. But I do feel like one way to actually start to talk about this is to talk about the relation between different types of language, the relation between different types of processes, and to talk about how, so an apple can have its common name but also a scientific name, but then also to say that within comparable to a religious practice is that attention is not just attention. A label or a thing that we do is not just a term. It's related to a whole connection of meaning and structure. So the apple is not just an apple. It also connects to other myth. I say myth is true, but connects to a range of things. So what I feel like is important within my journey is, in a sense, finding how these different things connect with one another. How can we talk about them harmoniously? But I actually do prefer, Gary's. I do prefer country as a term. I do feel like layering or an ecosystem is a much better language for it. So what I'll do is, with our last time, and I know that kind of moving through some of this is going fairly quickly, but what I would encourage you just to do is to, going back to initial conversation where I was talking about my story a little bit, I might invite you to reflect on, I guess, some of the primary challenges you feel as reflective practitioners. It is so. What are the things that you feel are challenging at present? What are some concerns that you have? And how do you, are there things related to research, or is it environmental? So rather than going into the the technology of whatever I've talked about. Can we just talk amongst ourselves about what challenges we feel at present, most feel at present, and how we, you know, then I can introduce another question and we can go for that. Does that sound okay? How long have we got?
So we have about 7 minutes.
Good. Well, let's take 3 minutes and then I'll interrupt with another question and then just to pose. So let's go, let's go for a few minutes. So what's the primary challenge that you're feeling at the moment? Primary challenge that you're feeling? Okay. All right. I'll just interrupt very quickly. Now, the second question will be, what is important for spirituality today? That'll be the second part of reflection. I'll just offer my own reflections, and given the ecosystem, the sense of the ecosystem here is that, you know, coming out of my experience with working with contemplative researchers and with my own traditional background, more traditional background, at least initially what I'm getting from here is sensitivity to language and the interaction of how language and processes work together. So although it's not a big statement by any means, I think one of the things that is coming out of my interactions with my research colleagues is a great sensitivity with how language of theology response and things interacts with persons to, you know, curate their experience. So I'll invite you now to just to talk about the second question, is what do you think is important for spirituality today? I'll invite you just to go talk back. We've got a couple of minutes?
Good.
Let's spend the last bit of time talking about what is important for spirituality today. So, would anyone in the last minute we've got, anyone like to share any reflections before we finish up? Any reflections to add just on the relation to the question that they feel comfortable with?
I've been preaching on this recently. So spirituality, this topic of seekers, I'm finding that people are going, they're not coming to Christianity or religious organisations for that. They're going to gospel choirs or to art exhibitions, or which is all. I think that they're connecting their spirituals and compassionate communities. They're going to the secular and other places to connect to their seeking. So that is an important issue. How can we sort of channel that so that we can be more part? We're looking down the barrel at organised religion of generational time.
That's right.
That's the baby boomerism, and then that's one of the issues that's standing out in my mind.
Good. I'll just quickly put a solution together, and I'll get back now. No. Thank you for offering that. We have a time?
Actually, because the time is up, we might actually move to the more general. So we might give thanks, Colin.
Thanks, everyone.